Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 2, Crowley Golden and the Isis Heart, a tale of Egyptian revival, written and performed for podcast by M.J. Hahn. Good evening, welcome to episode 12, and thanks for tuning in. So, listeners, last time we followed Crowley on his big night at the Sons of the City banquet, where he was due to receive his 5th generation award, and ended up getting more than he bargained for. Then, Yuki was getting strange signals from Tina Bleiberman that led her across town to an old warehouse. But more on that later. As we fade in over the city, you may notice that a certain fog bank has returned. And of course, by now, we all know that that can't mean anything good. Chapter 12, The Grand Ritual. The nighttime cityscape had been enveloped by a fog bank, which hadn't rolled in as much as it had suddenly materialized over downtown. The gray mist descended, drifting down in a ghostly pall that burned eerily orange in the streetlights below. A maintenance van pulled into the Pyramid Building's parking garage entrance. Inside the security station, under a cap that had been pulled down suspiciously low, the brass-faced uniformed guard gave a perfunctory nod and pushed a button on its control panel. The security barrier arm raised itself and the van rolled past. It began a winding descent towards the parking level. The tunnel ended and opened out into a vast expanse of formerly empty parking spaces, which were now occupied by row after row of identical hulking metallic figures. The squadron of armored guards all stood at grim attention, the eerie turquoise fire blazing from under each roughly hewn brow. As the van approached the freight elevator in the distance, it bounced over an unexpected speed bump, which caused its contents to shift slightly. Apparently, the space in the back of the van was a little cramped. This was the first thing that occurred to Crowley as he slowly emerged from unconsciousness and became aware of his surroundings. Well, perhaps aware would be a slight exaggeration. He was aware that he was lying on a cold metal floor of some kind which was rattling and vibrating. Then there was also his close proximity to some sort of snoring dead weight, which Crowley couldn't quite identify because, try though he might, he found that his eyes were determined to remain decidedly shut. And yet, this snoring deadweight also happened to be reeking of a particular cologne so pungent that Crowley felt his nostrils tingling. A thick cog turned over in Crowley's brain, and he realized it was the same god-awful stuff that Nolan had been stinking of during their limo ride earlier. The noxious odor seemed to be acting something like smelling salts, preventing Crowley from sinking back into foggy oblivion. Somewhere off in the murky distance, he could hear voices muttering, one that sounded like a textbook villain, and the other which sounded unmistakably like Randolph Sutton.
I'm sure the maestro won't mind accommodating my little request.
Ha! If you say so. Just as well, I suppose, since it looks like one of the faithful has gone missing.
Missing? Not your little brother.
Big brother, actually.
And won't that put a hitch into the evening's proceedings?
Nah, I wouldn't worry about it. The maestro will be taken by little Wilshire's enthusiasm. And as for the other, I don't know where Desmond thinks he's going. The last place you're gonna wanna be is out in the city tonight.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. What is this guy Anaximander got planned for the city anyway? Don't get me wrong, I'm all for a little mayhem. But what's the point if there's not gonna be nothing left to make any money off of?
Yeah, point well taken. This revival stuff is tricky business. But the maestro knows what he's doing, so not to worry.
While Crowley struggled to unravel what the two men were talking about, the van suddenly stopped and the rear doors were thrown open. Crowley felt a cold metal hand grip his ankle and pull with an unusual amount of force. His eyes fluttered open and were met with the burning gaze of the blank brass faceplate.
What's going on?
The brass figure hoisted Crowley abruptly over its shoulder. The icy burn of the cold metal began to find its way under Crowley's tuxedo, sending a shiver clear to his bones. The Shawapti spun around, and from his slightly capsized perspective, Crowley saw more of the brass figure striding forward to collect the inert figures of Nolan, Scott, and Blake from the back of the van. Naturally, Crowley's first instinct was to struggle, yet he was unable to wriggle free of his captor's icy grip. It was then that Crowley heard a voice that turned his blood to ice. Suddenly, the metal automaton's grip felt relatively toasty.
Uh-oh, it looks like somebody's waking up. No, we can't have this.
Crowley heard the clack of high heels, and then saw the familiar, floor-length white mink saunter into view.
Ah, Mr. Golden, of course you would be the one to give us a problem.
Crowley felt a taloned hand dig into his scalp and pull his head up by the roots of his hair. He squeezed his eyes shut, yet found himself unable to fight against the yellow fire which persistently leaked in through his eyelids and slowly pried them open. Audra chuckled as their gazes locked.
Good night, Mr. Golden. And this time, we will be saying adieu.
Crowley managed a pathetic warble before the yellow blaze flooded his vision, instantly extinguishing every ounce of his resistance. Audra beamed as Crowley's body went limp, hanging off of the Shwapti's shoulder. It was joined by three other brass figures, each with a fifth-generation award winner slung over its shoulder. The Shwapti trudged away in unison towards the freight elevator. Audra turned back to the van and smiled at the exiting figure of Randolph Sutton, followed closely by Danilov.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm happy to report that we are right on schedule.
Sutton's dark eyes twinkled from under his brow.
And what about your engineer, or whatever he's called, that Mortmain guy? Was he able to complete everything on the list?
Sutton seemed to be gesturing upwards at something, far off through the parking garage's ceiling.
He didn't have a lot of time to make all of the necessary modifications.
A sly smile crossed Audra's face.
Why, Mr. Sutton, rest assured that Monsieur Mortmain is a miracle worker. You'd be amazed at what he can do.
At this, Danilov chuckled as he did a quick scan over Audra's rather severe features.
Amazed. That's putting it lightly.
The ground floor of the enormous warehouse seemed to be deserted. Yuki O'Malley crept through the shadows while doing her best not to make a sound. The silver moonlight struggled to find its way in through the filthy windows, finally resolving itself into a dim luminescence that played tricks on Yuki's eyes. A few times her heart felt like it would jump out of her chest when the murky shadows coalesced into phantom shapes that stalked her from the darkest corners of the room. Yet the lonely warehouse remained quiet. The tall man that had driven away after loading all the candles into his van apparently had been the warehouse's only occupant that was living.
Well, let's hope so.
Despite the warehouse's ominous appearance, the sinister ambiance was decidedly offset by traces of a honeyed aroma that still lingered in the air. Yuki trailed past several large copper boilers which all smelled of beeswax. Then she had to step around pile after pile of discarded, sweetly scented tin cylinders which looked like homemade candle molds. And again, her mind flashed on the van full of enormous pillar candles.
Weird. What's with all the super-secret candle-making?
Upon finally reaching the far corner of the room, Yuki breathed a little sigh of relief when she saw the industrial stairwell that coiled upwards. There was even a faint light emanating hopefully from some sort of room above. Yuki shot up the winding stairwell until she finally burst into a room that made her feel like she had stepped into another world. She found herself standing in a strange, opulent oasis, surrounded by every conceivable modern convenience. Yuki paused to listen again, just to make sure that she was alone. The hideaway remained completely silent. Yuki crossed the gleaming stainless steel kitchen area while keeping her eyes peeled for any sign of Tina. Then, across the room, amid several empty cocktail glasses, a glint of brass in the center of the modern coffee table caught Yuki's eye. She lumbered past the large sectional sofa and gaped at the sight of Vernal Golden's dragonflyer.
Okay, how did that get here?
Yuki briefly recalled her previous visit to the cottage, where she had delivered two strange brass canisters to Grandpa Theo. How he had beamed at the sight of them and then shown her the crazy old workshop while asking her a lot of very specific questions about Tina Bleiberman. Yuki had to wonder if that conversation hadn't been the cause of this entire mess in the first place. Her mind boggled at the potential mischief that the combined forces of Bleeberman and Golden could instigate. Then, as if in rebuttal, another thunderous sonar ping sounded, jarring Yuki out of her thoughts. She had to be close now, judging by the intensity of the volume, the place where X marks the spot.
Come out, wherever you are.
Then Yuki heard the persistent rattling from a tiny glass bottle that was practically jumping off of the coffee table.
Tina, are you in there?
Yuki chuckled at the sight. Somehow she wasn't surprised to find Tina locked up like an evil djinn once again. Tina tended to have that effect on people.
I told you those guys were dangerous.
Yuki reached down and picked up the little bottle. It reacted instantly to her touch, buzzing and rattling like it was full of angry hornets.
Yeah, okay, just hang on a minute.
Yuki's fingers fumbled over the bottle's tiny stopper. As soon as it was loosened, Yuki felt the bottle tremble and the stopper shoot off in the distance like a champagne cork. Yuki was thrown back into the sofa cushions, where she landed on something spiky, causing the little bottle to fly out of her hands. It skipped across the floor while emitting a violent jet of phosphorescent vapor, which eventually coalesced into the form of Tina Bleeberman.
Took you long enough. I've been crammed in there for ages.
Yuki bristled while emerging from the sofa cushions, now holding a gaudy amethyst tiara.
I don't remember signing up for any rescue missions, so why don't we just start with a thank you, and maybe you can tell me how you ended up here in the first place.
Tina finished solidifying so her eye roll could be seen clearly.
Dude, the thank you is implied, okay? Hey, awesome! You found my tiara!
Tina rushed over in a blur and came back into focus with the tiara perched on her head at a jaunty angle. Each of the amethyst crystals twinkled while the power upgrade surged through her essence, casting her outline with a bright violet aura.
Kind of makes me feel all tingly.
Yuki narrowed her eyes.
Uh-huh. Very pretty. But it didn't seem to make a difference last time, did it? I told you not to go after those guys. Grandpa Theo said they were bad news, and then look what happened.
You're even there. I was totally blindsided. Can I help if they were too chicken to put up a fair fight?
Tina explained how she had been practically ambushed and then imprisoned in the blink of an eye by Anaximander's black magic. Or, to use Tina's exact words, the douchewad in the black suit of armor who had to use his hocus pocus because he was too much of a wuss to throw down. Suddenly, Tina brightened.
Hey, wait a minute. Speaking of throwdown, whatever happened to What's-Her-Face? The Wilshire Beast? Did you kick her stupid blonde ass like I told you?
Yuki's shoulders suddenly seemed to hunch, as if reminded of a heavy burden.
Not exactly.
And in turn, Yuki recounted all the details Tina had missed since her sudden disappearance, Yuki's tone of frustration slowly rising all the while. First, there was about how Yuki had called Grandpa Theo right after Tina had vanished, all hell-bent on vengeance. Then, all about the day of Wilshire Sutton reconnaissance in Union Square that had failed miserably. And finally, about how Yuki had spent her days since then agonizing over what had happened after both GT and Tina had seemingly fallen off of the face of the earth. Only to then learn that GT had been discovered in a cemetery at the same moment that Tina decided to play her own twisted version of psychic hide-and-go-seek. Tina looked at Yuki with a little smirk.
Okay, are you done now? Feeling better?
Yuki chuckled a little in spite of herself.
Guess I went a little crazy there. Sorry.
Well, yeah. It happens to the best of us.
Tina gave Yuki a friendly little nudge, which, despite her best intentions, still felt cold.
I don't know. That's really freaky about GT showing up in coma, because that night in the cemetery, something definitely weird was going down. Weird enough for all of our old friends from the Cursed Castle to be there, and I can't believe that old corpse is still walking around. Oh, yeah, and maybe you can explain to me sometime how Desmond Devinter ended up looking like an effing 5-year-old.
Yuki's eyes popped while Tina continued.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning. Wait till you hear this. I think there's going to be some majorly creepy stuff going down in the city tonight. I overheard those douchewads talking about everything while I was bottled up.
Wait, everything? Do I even want to know?
Yeah. I think you do. Because whatever they've got cooked up, I'm pretty sure Crowley is a part of it.
A look of panic suddenly washed over Yuki's face.
Crowley? What do you mean, part of it?
Crowley Golden was hovering just outside of consciousness. He could feel the bite of cold metal burning into his side, but was unable to move a muscle. He managed to open a single eye a tiny fraction, and realized that he was dangling in an awkward fireman's hold in the freezing grip of some sort of freaking brass armor. From this unusual vantage point, Crowley could see that his classmates were all in a similar predicament. The slumped, unconscious forms of Nolan, Blake, and Scott were all dangling over the shoulders of similar brass figures nearby in the curiously close quarters. Crowley's brain struggled to connect the dots. What were they all doing in a freight elevator? Crowley's thought was punctuated by a delicate ping, as well as a sudden metallic clunk as the elevator shuddered to a halt. The door slid open, and there was a sudden chill in the air. Crowley's captor began to move forward, causing its metal armor to burn into his side with every step. They walked down a corridor, up a short stairwell, and out through a security door which was being held open by another of the strange brass figures. Suddenly, the sound of foghorns moaned in the distance. The brass figures paced out into a large open space cast with harsh shadows at odd angles from the fluorescent security lights. Crowley managed to glance upward, and his mind boggled at the underside view of the towering spire above, the four planes of louvered steel that all came to a point high above, like the inside of a pyramid, or the pyramid building to be exact. While Crowley's brain attempted to fathom what these guys were up to, the four brass figures trudged forward towards the center of the space, where four stone slabs, arranged like the points of a compass, awaited them. Each of the Shawapti set down its burden, then turned and silently departed. Crowley found himself lying on the cold stone, with his feet directed towards the circle's center, and his head pointing due west. Despite his best efforts, Crowley could only lie still as the chill from the slab sank into his flesh. Only his eyes showed signs of life as they darted from side to side. Then, from somewhere in the distance, Crowley could hear low voices approaching. And as he strained to listen, suddenly the security lights were extinguished. In the darkness, a single strange word rang out, and an enormous circle of candles suddenly burst to life, filling the air with a sweet scent that was tinged with just a faint trace of decay and decomposition. An immense figure was now standing in the center of the circle. Crowley gaped at the sight of a gigantic suit of black armor, its scales gleaming with a strange luminescence in the flickering candlelight. Its fearsome helm was topped with a crown of jangled, twisted wires and odd bits of circuitry. Its narrow eye slits burned with turquoise fire, and in its clawed gauntlets, it held an enormous ruby. The towering figure crept around the fiery circle, leering over the slabs, whose occupants were each beginning to moan and struggle as they slowly regained consciousness. The black armor strutted into Crowley's view and then stopped, peering down at him. It drew a clawed finger across Crowley's cheek.
Such fine princes for our offering. Lord Anubis will be pleased.
The figure returned to the center of the circle and issued a command at one of the shadows lurking in the distance.
Brother Mortmain, we are ready. Let us set the stage so that the master may attend us.
There was a sound of a switch being thrown, and then the entire spire overhead began to groan with the clamor of straining metal. Crowley could merely stare upwards, blinking with disbelief as the spire began to shift, and then recede, somehow getting smaller until it floated away, and then completely disappeared from view altogether. The candles flickered, yet remained alight. Crowley's eyes popped at the velvety gray, foggy expanse of open sky above him. The black armor suddenly emitted a hollow laugh that made his skin crawl.
Excellent. A most befitting altar for our animus.
The crimson gleam of the Isis heart caught Crowley's eye as the black armored figure raised the ruby over its jagged crown and uttered an evil phrase. The words hissed like malicious serpents, slithering their way up through the air while they mingled into the night. The Isis heart suddenly burst with a crimson brilliance that radiated in all directions, like a horrible, shining watchfire of blood-red light. The black armored figure repeated its evil hissing phrase over and over, which seemed to bend the light to his will. The radiance shot up and expanded over the pyramid tower's newly exposed rooftop like a billowing curtain. It mushroomed over the neighboring skyscrapers until the whole of downtown was covered in a glimmering dome made of an unearthly scarlet-colored haze. Anaximander fell silent and lowered the ruby. With a final burst, the dome of burning light exploded into a crimson shockwave which sent the incantation screeching towards every corner of the city. The words seemed to permeate down through the asphalt, seeking those particular plots of dark earth below, where forgotten things from long ago still lay buried. And then, in the midst of all the typical Saturday night goings-on throughout the city, an eerie silence descended as the tremors began, and the sidewalks started to split open. High above, on his cold slab, Crowley could hear the sounds of screaming and panic begin to rise from below, punctuated by screeching tires and smashing glass. All the classic harbingers of bad things yet to come. Yet Crowley remained held in the firm grip of the strange paralysis, unable to do little else but lie there. Inside the circle of candles, he was keenly aware of others now standing over each of his classmates. Ajala Mall grinning wildly, the guy that Tina had described as the dude with the hair and the cape, and much to his surprise, the principal of Veracity High, Randolph Sutton. It was then that another figure walked up into view from behind him, a sweet face looking down at him, framed with perfectly arranged golden curls that wafted delicately on the breeze. For a split second, Crowley's muddled brain convinced him that an angel had come to his rescue. But when the angel spoke, it was like a sudden slap across his face that jarred Crowley back to his senses.
Hey, hotness. What you doing?
Wilshire beamed down at Crowley with a grin that stretched from ear to ear, which was an odd counterpoint to the rather lethal-looking ceremonial dagger that she held in her hands.
Wait, they're gonna do what?
Yuki stared out of the wall of windows which overlooked downtown. She had been listening intently to Tina's story about the Cruxon Sada, while every detail was recounted with the usual animated fervor. Gradually, Yuki felt a creeping sensation of dread begin to seize her, while Tina rolled her eyes for the umpteenth time.
Hello? Freaky death cult? What did you think they were gonna do?
Yuki scanned over the city skyline, which was gradually being obscured by an aberrant fog bank that seemed to be deliberately sulking over downtown. Her mind could only focus on one thought.
Crowley's in real trouble.
Yuki's eyes locked on the distant spire of the pyramid building as it faded in and out of view in the blanket of fog. It looked so far away. And then it occurred to Yuki that, in fact, it seemed to be moving further away.
Tina, you'd better have a look at this.
Tina shimmered over next to Yuki and then cried out in shock at the sight.
No way! Those a-holes have started already? Come on, there's no time to waste. We gotta kick it in the pants.
Okay, but I gotta make a phone call first.
Tina shimmered away while Yuki pulled her phone out of her jeans pocket and promptly dialed the cottage. Luckily, Morty Golden answered after the first ring. Although surprised to be hearing about it from Yuki, apparently Detective Golden had already been informed that something unusual was going on downtown. In one breath, Yuki had rattled off all of the pertinent facts. And when she had gotten to the part about Crowley, Yuki was relieved that Detective Golden didn't waste any time panicking or asking unnecessary questions. He calmly thanked Yuki for her help and hung up. Yuki spun around to find Tina patiently waiting while wearing a mischievous grin and clutching onto Vernal Golden's dragonflyer. The brass casing was vibrating at Tina's touch. The two battery canisters that made up the dragonflyer's eyes were steadily growing brighter, burning with a blue-green light. Tina beamed.
Same thing happened the last time I got close to this thing. Here, better let me help you get this on.
Before she could protest, Tina had Yuki all buckled up with a dragonflyer strapped securely on her back. Yuki shivered at the device's touch. There was a decidedly uncomfortable chill wherever the cold brass came close to her skin. Not to mention the variety of odd clickings and whirrings that rang in Yuki's ears as the device slowly came to life. It almost sounded like a time bomb, which made Yuki look a little nervous.
The ticking? Is it supposed to do that?
Yeah, it's just recharging.
Now Yuki looked perplexed.
So, how do you know when it's full or whatever?
Yuki's question was answered with the distant ringing of a little bell from inside the brass casing. Tina chuckled.
Cool. Guess that answers that. Okay. So, who's ready for a little rescue mission?
Yuki nodded a little hesitantly while looking around the room, judging that there was plenty of ceiling clearance, but maybe a little too much furniture for a convenient test run.
Wait, shouldn't we go outside first?
Tina burst out laughing.
What? Are you kidding? I think we're way past being polite here.
Tina fired off a single, well-placed fireball, which conveniently removed the wall of windows as well as a large portion of the roof. The cool night air rushed in as they gazed out at the sight of the red glimmering dome of light which seemed to be spreading out over the city. Somehow it seemed to be emanating from the top of the pyramid tower. Yuki shuddered.
Okay, that can't be good.
Yeah, no kidding. Come on, let's get out of here. Now, where did GT say that stupid flap was?
Yuki saw that Tina was scanning the side of the dragon flyer, until at last she located the hidden little sliding flap which housed the on switch. With a simple flick, two pairs of large wings made of blazing turquoise light suddenly sprang out and began to quiver, sending papers flying and cocktail glasses tumbling over. Yuki found that she was now hovering effortlessly just above the floor.
Whoa!
Tina smiled with a look of satisfaction.
Awesome. Now, try to steer. GT said all you had to do was lean in a little in the direction that you want to go, or something like that.
Yuki tentatively craned her neck, and the dragon flyer reacted instantly. Yuki managed to squeak of surprise before she was suddenly careering sideways across the room, completely out of control. Tina rolled her eyes.
I said a little!
The clamor of destruction sounded from every corner. Pots and pans were flying in every direction from the kitchen.
Whoa!
The dining room table and chairs were overturned. Then a mad dash through the living area until Tina managed to grab Yuki by the legs and anchor her down. The dragon flyer had carved a path of destruction across the formerly opulent hideaway. Sofa cushions were now singed and smoldering. The flat-screen TV had been cut in two like it was butter. Tina looked delighted.
Nice! A little demolition is just what this place needed.
When Yuki had stabilized, Tina released her grip, and the dragon flyer merely hovered harmlessly once more.
Okay, let's try that again. Are you ready? Here, let me give you a boost.
Before Yuki could offer a response, Tina had grabbed her by the dragon flyer's shoulder straps and then bolted out through the broken wall. They flew out into the night to the sound of Yuki's squeals of surprise. It seemed that the dragon flyer had needed only a little help to get off the ground. Now it steadily hummed along, easily holding Yuki's slight frame aloft. Together they soared skyward until the streetlights twinkled far below. For a split second, Yuki allowed herself the sheer amazement of sensation as they zoomed along. This was certainly a far cry from her typical Saturday evening in front of the TV.
Wow, I could get used to this.
Tina grinned from alongside her.
I know, right? Hey, you know what they say. Flying's the only way to travel. Okay, now the hard part. Let's try to climb. Remember, you have to turn into the wind.
What did you say?
Tina rolled her eyes again as Yuki suddenly plummeted in a rather spectacular nosedive towards 7th Street.
That's not turning into the wind!
Tina's tiara sparked up instantly, and in a violet flash, she dove after Yuki, who looked like some sort of deranged, flailing Tinkerbell as she plunged towards certain death. Yuki was hopelessly flapping her arms and screaming her head off, when, with a sudden little jerk, her death drop was interrupted and she was upright once more. Tina smiled.
Gotcha. Okay, let's not do that again.
With a sigh of relief, Yuki realized that Tina had swooped in and hoisted her up by the shoulder straps. The effect was like an instant spectral autopilot. The dragon flyer leveled out, picked up speed, and began to climb once more. Yuki's toes skimmed over the telephone wires as they shot out over Market Street, heading towards downtown. It was then that Yuki saw the crowds. She couldn't believe her eyes.
Tina, do you see what I see?
If you mean the legions of Walking Dead down there? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I do.
What are they doing? Where did they all come from?
Tina smirked.
There's a death cult in town? What? You've forgotten the zombie skeletons under the golf course already? GT said there was lost cemeteries all over the place.
Tina's words sunk in as they regained altitude. Even as they climbed, Yuki could hear the sounds of mayhem below. Cars skidding and crashing, glass shattering and people screaming. Not to mention the dull chorus of groans from the grisly, shambling throng.
I don't believe this is happening.
Yeah? Well, believe this. It looks like they're all headed in the same direction as us.
Yuki chanced to look down and gasped. Much to her astonishment, she saw that Tina was correct. A virtual river of the walking dead seemed to be relentlessly rolling towards downtown. And as they closed in on the pyramid building, block by block, it occurred to Yuki that this deathly tide seemed to be growing in scale. More of the cadaverous figures were now approaching from the north and east, as well as the south, all seeming to converge around the pyramid tower.
Okay, are you ready to try landing? Notice I said landing, not crashing.
While Tina zoomed forward, aiming for one of the building's elevator hoistways, which sat on either side of the tapering structure like slumping shoulders, the strange rooftop ceremony came into sharper focus. Now they could see the colossal suit of black armor standing in the center of a circle of tall pillar candles. The candles which surrounded the four supine bodies, each lying on a slab, with a mysterious silhouette standing over them. It didn't take long before Yuki spotted Wilshire Sutton grinning down at the immobile figure of Crowley while holding a sharp, evil-looking dagger. Yuki screamed above the howling
Crowley,
wind.
No!
Okay, scratch the landing part. Hang on!
Tina's tiara sparked up as she clamped onto Yuki's arm and sped forward in a streak of purple light.
Crap! I think we're too late!
Tina's words were lost as the tall suit of black armor began its dark invocation.
Lord Anubis, I call unto thee. Your faithful have all assembled for your glory. Accept these sacrifices and open the gates to the Hall of Judgment unto me.
A circle of white light blazed around Anaximander, flooding his imposing form, then expanding to engulf his four recumbent offerings. On his command, each of the standing figures brought their daggers down. Time seemed to freeze into a snapshot of blinding white light, while Wilshire Sutton sank the long, twisted dagger into Crowley Golden's chest. And so, Chapter 12 comes to a close. Guess there really isn't much more to say, except... Ah! Special thanks go to guest voices, Lisa Snare as Tina, Leanne Parker as Yuki, and Tristy Taylor as Wilshire. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. I'd also like to thank Random Coil UK for their cover of Satie's Nausean No. 1. For more information, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 13 and the conclusion of our story. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.